Chapter 40. It must be hard being a double agent. The first half of the chapter. The streets Carr took to the National Theatre were mostly empty. Here and there he could see a restaurant open for business, but all the other shop owners in town had rolled down their shutters. The last stragglers were leaving the tea houses, exhausted by their long day of drinking tea and smoking cigarettes. But even on the way out, their eyes remained glued to the television. As he approached the National Theatre, Carr saw three army vehicles. They all had their lights on, and when Carr looked down the lane, he saw the shadow of a tank nestling among the oleanders. The thaw had begun in earnest that evening, and the icicles that had formed on the eaves of houses were dripping water onto the pavements below. Walking under the live transmission cable that stretched across Ataturk Avenue, he entered the theatre and, taking the key from his pocket, pressed it into the palm of his hand. The theatre was empty except for the soldiers and policemen lined up along the aisles, listening to the echoes of the actors rehearsing. Carr settled down into one of the empty seats to enjoy Sunayi's deep, rich voice and perfect diction, Kadife's weak and wavering answers, and Funde Esser's hectoring direction. "Say it with feeling, darling Kadife," as she rushed about the stage, moving the props, a tree, and a vanity table. While Funde Esser was rehearsing a scene with Kadife, Sunayi noticed the embers of Carr's cigarette and came to sit next to him. "These are the happiest moments of my life," he said. He stank of raki, but didn't seem at all drunk. "No matter how much we rehearse, everything depends on how we feel when we walk on stage. But it's clear already that Kadife has a talent for improvisation." "I've brought her a message from her father and also an eye of Fatima for protection," said Carr. "Do you think I could have a word with her in private?" "We know you've given your bodyguards the slip. I hear the snow is melting and the trains are about to run again. But before any of this happens, we're determined to put on our play," Sunayi said. "Has Blue hidden himself well, for once?" he added with a smile. "I don't know." Sunayi stood up and called Kadife over. Then he returned to the rehearsal. The spotlight came on, and as he looked at the three figures framed on stage, Carr could sense their deep affinity for one another. Looking at Kadife, at the scarf still draped around her head, he was alarmed at the ease with which she now negotiated the intimate world of the stage. And if she was to bare her head, Carr thought, what a shame that she would still be wearing one of those ugly raincoats favored by all covered women. How much closer to her he would have felt if, like her sister, she'd been wearing a skirt and showing off those long legs of hers. But when she left the stage to sit with him, there was a moment when he understood why Blue had left Ipek and fallen in love with Kadife instead. "Kadife, I've seen Blue. They released him and he's found himself a hiding place. But he doesn't want you to go on stage and bare your head tonight. He sent you a letter." Lest Sunayi should see him, he passed her the letter under his arm, as one might pass the answers to a friend during an exam. But Kadife made no effort at concealment. She read the letter openly and smiled, so it was some time before Carr saw the tears in her angry eyes. "Your father thinks the same thing, Kadife. You might be right in deciding to bare your head, but it would be insane to do it this evening in front of all those angry religious high school boys. There's no need for you to stay. You can tell them you're ill." "I don't need an excuse. Sunayi's already told me I'm free to go home if I wish." It was clear to Carr that he was not dealing with some young girl upset at failing in her last-minute bid for permission to appear in the school play. The anger and heartbreak he read in her face were far too deep. "So, are you planning to stay here, Kadife?"
"Yes. I'm staying here, and I'm doing the play."
"Do you know how much this will upset your father?"
"Give me the evil eye he sent me."
"I just mentioned an evil eye so they'd let me speak to you privately."
"It must be hard being a double agent."
He could tell Kadife was heartbroken, and it was with some pain that he realized the girl's mind was far away. He wanted to take her by the shoulders and embrace her, but he did nothing of the sort. "Ipek has told me about her old relationship with Blue," Carr said. Kadife took out a pack of cigarettes, slowly raised a cigarette to her lips and lit it. "I gave him the cigarettes and the lighter you sent with me," Carr said clumsily. For a few moments, neither spoke. "Are you doing this because you're so in love with Blue? What is it about him that makes you love him so much, Kadife? Tell me, please." When Carr saw that he was digging himself into a hole, he fell silent. Funde Esser called from the stage to announce that they'd come to Cardiff's next scene. She gave Carr a tearful look and stood up. At the last moment, they embraced each other. Still feeling her presence, still smelling her scent, Carr lingered for a while to watch the play, but his mind was elsewhere. He did not understand a thing. He could no longer trust his instincts. He was missing something. Jealousy and remorse were defeating his every effort to think logically. He could barely manage to identify what was causing him such pain. What he couldn't fathom was why this pain was so destructive, so violent. Looking ahead to those years he hoped to spend with Ipek in Frankfurt, assuming he succeeded in getting her to go with him, he could now see that this crushing, soul-destroying pain would eat away at their happiness. And as he thought this, he lit a cigarette, his mind stubbornly refusing to make order of things. He went off to the toilet where he'd met with Necip 2 days earlier and walked into the same stall. Opening the window high on the wall, he looked out at the black night and stood there, puffing helplessly. At his first intimation that another poem was on the way, he could hardly believe it. Holding his breath, he pulled out his notebook to jot it down. He hoped the poem had been sent to console him, to give him hope, but when it was done, he still felt crushing pain throughout his body, so he left the National Theatre in distress. When he reached the snowy pavement, he decided the cold air would do him good. His 2 army bodyguards were still with him, and his mind was in total disarray. At this point, to enhance the enjoyment of my story and make it easier to understand, I must cut short this chapter and start a new one. It doesn't mean that Carr did nothing more worth narrating, but rather that I must first locate the place where the world ends, the poem Carr jotted down with so little effort, which would be the last in the book he would entitle Snow.